failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. Our guest will be Jacob Solem, the reporter and author of the book Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use, and we'll also hear from Raina Stepinski of the Drug Policy Alliance, who will report on the situation in New Mexico. We'll also hear from Phil Jackson, who will give us the black perspective on the drug war, and this editorial from the Drug Truth Network. They smuggle these commodities over the U.S.-Mexican border on a daily basis, sometimes in large loads in the back of 18-wheelers, but mostly through mom-and-pop smugglers of small loads in car trunks, hidden compartments, and recreational vehicles. These commodities are associated with a terrible wave of violence that stays mostly on the Mexican side of the Rio Grande, but which also spills onto America's shores when heavily armed Mexican military or police escort drug shipments into Texas, New Mexico, and California. Too often, these commodities wind up in the hands of children. It fuels the deadly cartel's mad frenzy for power. These commodities, as reported by the Houston Chronicle, are taking a, quote, deadly toll, end quote. The prohibition of drugs is the most ignorant, superstitious, idiotic mechanism of supposed control ever put in place by mankind. The commodities I'm talking about are guns, weapons, manufactured and sold in the United States and smuggled into Mexico to ensure the drug war remains the solid success it has become for the weapons makers, the cartels, the bankers, the oil companies, the pharmaceutical houses, the alcohol and tobacco companies, the cops, the district attorneys, the judges, the politicians, and all the eternal war profiteers.
Guns, oil, and drugs. Guns, oil, and drugs. Guns, oil, and drugs. Guns, oil, and drugs.
I hope my singing doesn't aggravate you too much. Now, here's our interview with reporter from Reason Magazine, Mr. Jacob Solem.
And I write a syndicated newspaper column. I've been writing about the war on drugs for most of my career.
And, Jacob, you also have a book, Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use. Is that correct?
That's right.
You have an article online at Reason.com. It's titled Down from the High. Do Bush's drug warriors have a time machine? Please tell us about that article.
Well, this is discussing the claim by the Bush administration that the recent decline in self-reported drug use among teenagers has something to do with the Bush administration's policies. That was a claim that Bush made implicitly in his State of the Union address, and if you look at the latest anti-drug strategy from the federal government, which just came out the other day, it's even more explicit there that they're trying to take credit for the decline in teenage drug use. They speak of it as one of their successes. The main problem with that is that this is a trend that began well before Bush took office, administration. That's when drug use, as measured by the government surveys, peaked among teenagers, started to go down after 96 or 97 or so. So it's sort of just on the face of it, it's difficult for them to take credit for that trend. This is reminiscent of what happened at the beginning of the Reagan administration, where drug use also declined, but it was a trend that, again, began before Reagan took office. Nowadays, you will often hear Republicans take credit for the decline in drug use during the 80s. Now, his policies might have had something to do with the continuation of that trend, but they clearly didn't start it, and the same is true of Bush.
Well, Jacob, as I perceive it, the government takes these stats, twists them, warps them to suit their needs, and their need being to somehow justify this ongoing war on drugs. The drug czar, I've been trying to contact him and
Karen Tandy, the czarina at the DEA, to get them to come on our shows, and they absolutely refuse. Your thoughts, sir, when will we get to the heart of this matter?
Well, there's no upside for them to debate the war on drugs. They're in the position of power. They're defending the status quo. It can only hurt them to appear in a forum with any critic of the war on drugs who knows anything about drug policy. There's no benefit for them into getting into that kind of debate. I think they're operating from a position of strength, and tactically, I think that's the right decision. They should avoid discussing drug policy with anybody who might be at all critical. But the fact that they resort to this kind of obvious trickery, I mean, it's just, even on the face of it, you can't make the argument that he's responsible for this trend. You know, even if it did coincide, even if the trend did coincide with the Bush administration, he would still want to know, was that just a coincidence? You know, did it actually have something to do with his policies? Or is it just you know, it so happened that drug use began to decline around the time that he took office? But that's not even the case. It didn't even begin to decline around the time that he took office. And furthermore, there's a problem with coming up with a plausible explanation, even if it met all these tests. In other words, even if the trend began after he took office, you'd want to know, well, you know, how was it that he got teenagers to smoke less pot, right? Because that's basically what we're talking about. This is most drug use is marijuana use. Most of the decline among teenagers was a decline in self-reported marijuana use. So that Bush did, or that he thinks that he did, since he took office, that made teenagers less likely to smoke pot. I don't think there's any plausible supply-side explanation for that. In other words, I don't think they went after the supply of marijuana in such a way that they made it very. The survey data on availability don't support that idea. Availability seems to be about constant since the mid-90s, judging from what teenagers say in these surveys. You know, so it's not a supply-side thing. I don't think there's any evidence that the supply of marijuana has been disrupted in any kind of noticeable way. So is it a demand-side thing? Does he think that his anti-drug ads convinced teenagers not to smoke pot because they suggested that drug users support terrorism, or because they suggested that if you smoke pot you might accidentally shoot your friend, you know, or run somebody over? You know, maybe, you know, but maybe the, you know, the same ridiculous sort of ridiculous ads that ran during the Clinton administration should also be given credit for reducing you know, teenagers' inclination to smoke pot. You know, so it's all sheer speculation. They want to claim basically any positive trend that they see, or any reduction in drug use that they can cite that occurred on their watch, they want to take credit for. But you really, in addition to a correlation, you need to have some kind of plausible explanation for how they managed to do that.
Jacob, we're talking about government obfuscation of fact. And the truth be told, that even if the use of marijuana has gone down, the fact is that teenagers are smoking more tobacco, they're doing more pills, they're doing more inhalants, and the government never wants to talk about that, right?
Well, I mean, they do talk about that sometimes. I mean, the thing about these statistics is that no matter what they show, they can be used as an argument to support the war on drugs. In other words, if a certain kind of drug use is going up in a certain demographic group, well, that shows you we need to spend more money because this is a terrible crisis, right? And we've got to attack it. If a certain drug use is going down within a certain demographic group, well, it shows you that what we're doing is working, so we have to spend more money. We have to double our efforts, right? So it doesn't matter what actually happens. They can always use, whatever the data show, they can use the data as an excuse to spend more money to continue with the war on drugs. And that just shows you their fundamental dishonesty, because there is no scenario. There is no set of data that you could have, that you could imagine, where they would say, you know what, maybe we're wrong. Maybe we should reconsider our approach. It doesn't matter what actually happens, or what the data show, but whatever happened to insist on the same course. They're really impervious to data in that sense. You really, aside from looking at trends in drug use, and again, I guess we should note that there is a measure of uncertainty with any of these data, because they all rely on self-reports. Well, how honest is the average teenager when you ask him, in one of these surveys, even though it's confidential, how honest is he about his drug use? That's a big question. Not only might he be worried about getting into trouble if he doesn't completely believe that it's confidential, he may just be screwing around. You know, your average teenager filling out one of these surveys may decide to make stuff up. And the result of that could be that there's an exaggeration of drug use, right? He might pretend to have used drugs that he didn't use, or he might, if he didn't use drugs, he's not really cool, and so he might exaggerate it for that reason. Even given those uncertainties, the trends over time should tell you something, right? I mean, assuming these incentives to lie or misrepresent your drug use are basically the same over time, if you see the trends going up or down, that still should signify something. But even if it does, teenagers who really have a serious problem with marijuana or with other drugs, is that the number of those teenagers, is it going down? Right? Because you could, maybe, what if every teenager who smoked pot a few times a year and never gets into any serious trouble as a result, if every one of them stops smoking pot, very impressive-looking decline in drug use. All of the serious potheads who are, you know, fucking out of school and getting into serious trouble as a result of using marijuana, they continue using as they had before. That would still look like a success, right? So you have to make these kinds of distinctions. Of course, the government never does that. They will latch on to any kind of decline in drug use as a promising trend, even if it's not a good measure of really problematic drug use.
Well, Jacob, one of the successes that John Walters, the drug czar, seems to be touting of late is that, I think he said, every week they have one more school that signs on for testing of their students for drugs. Your thoughts, sir, is that a success?
Well, I mean, he seems like he is determined to test every American if possible, because not only does he want every student to be tested, and, you know, start beginning at a certain point in time, we're all going to go through high school. You and I may have escaped the drug testing in high school, but from here on in, if every school starts doing this, everybody who goes through high school will be tested. He also wants every employer to test their employees, right? So if you start talking about testing every student and every employee, that's a pretty big chunk of the American population. You know, I'm not sure if he's going to start going into old age homes and But ultimately, the goal is to create a deterrent to drug use by testing as many Americans as they possibly can. And it really has nothing to do with safety concerns. Their main point is to deter drug use, regardless of the consequences of the drug use. So it's not, he wants every employer to do this, even if it doesn't really make sense for the employer to do it, even if it's not a good measure of impairment, which it isn't. You know, if somebody tests positive for marijuana on a urine test, it doesn't show that he's impaired. Even if it really doesn't address any of the employer's problems with efficiency or safety, he still wants them to do this testing.
We're speaking with Jacob Solem, a writer for Reason Magazine, author of the book Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use. Jacob, we've been talking about, again, the disparity for the drug war, as presented by the drug czar and others. And I guess my question to you, you've taken the time to examine the voluminous information in regards to drug use and the policy of prohibition. Is there an upside? Can it ever be won? What do you see on the horizon?
Well, obviously I hope that it can be, or I'd be wasting my time. I think that people, when they see and examine the history of drug policy, and when they see the facts about the current policy, they can be persuaded. Not everyone. John Walters is not going to be persuaded. You know, there's some true believers out there who will continue to support the war on drugs no matter what, but I think probably most Americans are in a middle position where they are afraid of drugs. They're inclined to support the current drug laws because they're afraid of drugs and what they think drugs do. But at the same time, they're troubled by the costs of the war on drugs. And the more you can bring home to them those costs, the more inclined they will be to question the war on drugs. And especially the more you can distinguish between the harms that are actually caused by drug use or drug abuse and the harms that in fact are due to prohibition. Not everyone makes that distinction. The more they understand that distinction, I think the more inclined they will be to support serious reform. So it's not a hopeless task, and especially in the case of marijuana, I think there certainly has been a shift in public opinion over the last few decades. I think most Americans would probably agree that, you know, smoking marijuana is not such a big deal, not the sort of thing you should go to jail for example. And then I guess the question becomes, if smoking marijuana itself is not such a big deal, why is it such a big deal to help people smoke pot? Why should the people who either grow their own or sell other people marijuana, why should they go to jail? And I haven't heard a satisfactory answer to that question, because it seems to me that the essence of the crime, the thing that people are trying to prevent, the government is trying to prevent, and that the people are fearful of, is the actual drug use. But in this case, you have the actual crime being punished less severely than aiding and abetting the crime, by providing the drug. That's a sort of strange situation, and I'd like to get people to think more about that, because if in fact smoking pot is not such a big deal, then it really shouldn't be such a big deal to help people smoke pot.
772,000 nonviolent citizens of these United States were arrested in 2005 alone for the possession of flowers. I recently spoke with Rena Sapansky, the Drug Policy Alliance director in New Mexico.
There's a lot going on in New Mexico at this time. One of the drug czar's reps came out there and tried to chide the legislators, but it didn't go so well, did it?
It actually took almost 2 hours in providing testimony during that committee hearing, which is just an outrageous amount of time in a 30-day session, legislative session here in New Mexico. So I think just the length of his testimony really hurt him. But, he focused a lot on problems that he feels occurs after legalization. This bill is not marijuana legalization. It's legal access to medical marijuana. And it's a very restrictive bill. The senators actually picked up on this really quickly and really pinned him down. There was some really wonderful testimony, and in the end, I think it was the Senate Majority Leader who said, "I hope if you ever go to another state that you do not insult their people the way you have insulted us." So it was a pretty incredible hearing.
Well, I think this decades-old war on marijuana and drug users is really a slap in the face to all of us. Your thoughts, ma'am? Are we going to get that bill passed in New Mexico?
We're all here visualizing that it's going to pass on Tuesday, on Valentine's Day, is the ultimate sign of love and compassion for our sick and dying. But, you know, we are wasting so much money in prosecuting patients in this state, and the pain and the suffering is not being dealt with effectively. We just want this to be an option that medical providers can have at their fingertips in order to provide the best care for their patients.
Since he's come back to the Drug Truth Network fold, Mr. Phil Jackson has won national accolades for his black perspective on the drug war.
And now for another black perspective on the drug war.
What's the matter with you, boy? Don't you know I got a right to sing the blues? Listen at this.
In March of 1931, Louis Satchmo Armstrong got arrested for possession of gauge. Now, back in those days, people who smoked and respected marijuana called themselves vipers, and marijuana went by many names like tea, muggles, reefers, and gauge. Long before rap and rock, jazz was the devil's own music that corrupted young minds and destroyed their lives. Though most people dancing to tunes like Golden Leaf Strut, Song of the Viper, or Texas Tea Party didn't know they had cannabis to thank. Louis Armstrong is quoted in one biography as saying, "We always looked at pot as a sort of medicine, a cheap drunk, and with much better thoughts than one that's full of liquor." Louis Armstrong's arrest came because a rival band leader, jealous of his success, dropped a nickel on Armstrong and ratted him out to police. They all did snitches rotten hell. At that time, the penalty he faced for possession was 6 months in jail, and his trial made headlines. His boss, his manager, and his legal dream team got the popular musician off with a suspended sentence, and Satchmo went back to work the same night. Louis Armstrong died in 1971, but he left behind some thoughts on the drug war in a letter to his sweetheart, Mary Warner. "Mary Warner, honey, you sure was good, and I enjoyed you heap much, but the price got a little too high to pay, law-wise. At first, you was a misdemeanor, but as the years rolled on, you lost your mister and got meaner and meaner, jailhousely speaking. So, bye-bye, I'll have to put you down, dearest. Signed, soulfoodly, Satchmo." From the Drug Truth Network this Black History Month, this is Phil Jackson.
We do have time, and I'd like to present part of an interview I did with Mr. Bruce Merkin, the Director of Communications for the Marijuana Policy Project. Their website, mpp.org.
Okay, once again, we're joined by our good friend, the Director of Communications at the Marijuana Policy Project, Mr. Bruce Merkin. Bruce, there's so much news happening in the medical marijuana front. Tell us what's going on.
One from the state of Illinois is that our medical marijuana bill there is heading for its first committee hearing, Senate, next week, so we're gearing up for that. And, of course, we've got medical marijuana legislation moving forward in the state of New Mexico. It's already passed the Senate there, and they got a visit from one of the drug czars by the name of David Murray. On the more negative side, the White House yesterday unveiled its national drug control strategy. In general, they're pretty much pursuing the same old, by amazing lack of coincidence, they announced it at a press conference in Denver, a city which, of course, last November voted to end marijuana penalties under ordinances, making it clear that they're going to campaign aggressively against any reform efforts anywhere. So it's the same old nonsense from the White House, but I think it's increasingly clear that the public is not listening to them so much.
Bruce, I know that you guys have, by that I mean Marijuana Policy Project, has tried to have debates with members of government about this decades-old problem. And yet, we never can seem to get them up to the podium to step up to the plate, if you will. I'm currently going after Karen Tandy of the DEA, John Walters of the ONDCP, to invite them to come on my show. Any advice?
Well, all I would say is don't schedule your show and plan your show around them showing up, because my guess is they're going to run like hell. And in fact, local activists in Denver yesterday again tried to challenge Walters to debate with no result at all. And interestingly enough, Walters fell back on his standard tactic of trying to demonize anybody who criticizes current policies. Sort of bizarrely, he blamed the Denver Marijuana Initiative on George Soros. Soros had nothing to do with it. The campaign was run on a shoestring budget. They spent altogether something like $30,000. But it seems like, not having any actual facts on his side, Walters simply resorts to name-calling and trying to say, oh, these are bad people, instead of the truth, which is that simply honest citizens are increasingly wondering why we have some of these laws in the first place.
You know, the budget you speak of, they have hundreds, if not thousands of times more dollars that they spend in persecuting this drug war. If people out there are tired of it, like we've been talking about, people who stand up like Mason Tavert, what can people do? How can they get involved with the Marijuana Policy Project?
Well, they can log on to our website. That's probably the simplest thing to do, which is mpp.org, mpp.org. And when you get onto our website, there's all sorts of information, of course, and we make it very easy for you to sign up for free email alerts that will let you know what's going on, what legislation is being considered both in Congress and in your particular state. And we make it very easy to, when that happens, to send a message to your legislators, your representatives, and let them know what you think. And it's really important that more and more people do that, because politicians, frankly, don't understand that this is a genuine popular movement, and there's lots of people out there who care about these things. And they need to hear from folks, and they need to hear again and again and again.
Well, you know, it's been decades, as I mentioned earlier, that there's been this propaganda campaign, this superstition, if you will, in this regard, and people have been afraid to broach the subject in public or with their public officials. But there's enough data out there to do it with courage, is there not?
Well, I think there is. And what's interesting is that, again, yesterday, John Walters and the local officials who were with him were falling back on scare stories instead of data and facts. They did their press conference at a treatment center, and they managed to find a couple of recovering drug-addicted moms who told tearful stories about having started with marijuana, therefore marijuana must be a gateway drug. Well, scientifically, we know that that's nonsense. We know there's nothing about marijuana that causes people to use anything else. Of course, people tend to start with it, or alcohol or tobacco, because they're the most common. But that's a very different thing from saying that one causes the other. And this is just a standard stock in trade of theirs, of confusing correlation with causation, trying to confuse people instead of dealing with what the data actually tells us.
Okay, my friends, once again, I am trying to get Karen Tandy, the administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, or Mr. John Walters, the director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, to appear here on the Drug Truth Network and to explain for us the reason, the need for eternal drug war. Here's part of a letter I wrote both of them. It's slightly different between the two, but I'll read it to you. My name's Dean Becker. I'm a reporter based in Houston, Texas, with KPFT radio station. Currently, I produce 9 radio programs per week about the drug war for 50 affiliate stations in the U.S. and Canada, 7 3-minute pieces for daily distribution, and 2 1-half-hour programs. Our guests range from U.S. congressmen to Canadian senators, from Nobel laureates to prison wardens. We write to invite Ms. Tandy or Mr. Walters to be our guest or his or her designate for approximately 20 minutes on our flagship program, Cultural Baggage. We prefer to do our half-hour programs live if possible, but we could pre-record if necessary. Each week we produce a segment we call The Official Government Truth, utilizing stats from the DEA, ONDCP, and other entities. It would be a plus if we could get an official of the government to underline these pronouncements over the airwaves. And, of course, I've not had any luck with that thus far. I did hear from Garrison K. Courtney. He's the acting chief of media affairs for the Drug Enforcement Administration, and he wrote me back, Drew, he didn't even get my name right. I don't think we'll be able to get the administrator for this request, but am looking at other alternatives. And, of course, I wrote him back and said, my name is Dean Garrison, just like in my email address. What alternatives do you have in mind? I'm looking forward to your response. Logic and proportion are overtaking superstition and propaganda. Let's talk about it. And I haven't heard anything else from either the DEA or the ONDCP, but I didn't expect to. Their lack of substantive response once again empowers me to call them liars and cowards.
Let me tell you what cocaine does. According to the government, first-time cocaine users experience a feeling of euphoria that lasts 10 to 15 minutes with a small amount of cocaine. The euphoric feeling becomes more and more difficult to obtain, requiring larger amounts of cocaine. The user begins to snort the drug uncontrollably. They become erratic and violent. They can't eat or sleep. They develop serious health conditions, heart disease, strokes, seizures, even anorexia and severe bowel gangrene, and eventually die, most commonly of cardiac arrest or respiratory seizure. And that's not all. According to the DEA, cocaine is often adulterated with chalk, laundry detergent, meat tenderizer, and even rat poison. Don't believe me? Look it up at whitehousedrugpolicy.gov. Drug legalization advocates would have this poison in every corner store. So ask yourself this. Is that what you want? This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
There is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, or medical data involved in this drug war. It is a sham. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. Prohibido, Istak, Ulesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.